This is PCJ Radio International.
From PCJ Radio International, welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Perron. Cambodia's opposition party says it's preparing to file a complaint to the International Criminal Court against Prime Minister Hun Sen. It follows the government crackdown on striking factory workers last week that left at least four dead. From Cambodia, we have this report from San Botaleto.
The International Criminal Court, the ICC, prosecutes individuals for genocide, crimes against humanity and war crimes. Cambodia's opposition party wants to use it to prosecute the Prime Minister Hun Sen over violent clashes last week that left at least four people dead. It's an ambitious ploy, and one that many are saying is unlikely to be successful.
I think the crackdowns, the violent crackdowns and the history of violence by this government grossly violated human rights, but I doubt that the ICC will take the case.
That's Virak U, president of the Cambodia Centre for Human Rights. Mr. U believes the strategy will ultimately undermine the objectives of the opposition Cambodia National Rescue Party, the CNRP.
I think CNRP's best hope is actually with the Cambodian people. There's a lot of momentum. There's a lot of discontent of the current government. And people do want change. People do want reforms. And I think the best hope is actually to get the people on board, to get the people active and involved in a peaceful manner. I think that would be the best hope for the CNRP to push the agenda.
The CNRP has been leading rallies and strikes to call for a new election, claiming the last one in July was illegitimate because of fraud and other irregularities. In recent weeks, the opposition and anti-government protesters joined thousands of garment workers who'd been demanding the government double their monthly minimum wage. Deadly violence erupted last Friday when police fired shots to disperse the crowd. Opposition leader Sam Rainsy says his supporters won't be intimidated.
Now we are working on the diplomatic front, on the commercial front, on the legal front. We are in touch with union and workers' organization all over the world to condemn violence on workers and to help workers achieve their goal, their demand of $160 a month as a minimum wage.
But Mr. U from the Cambodia Centre for Human Rights says the government's hardline response has already started to affect people's expectations for government reform.
I was so enthusiastic. I was so energetic and I was positive in the past 5 months or so, a few weeks before the election and after the elections, there seems to be momentum for real change, for real reforms. That's been crashed in the past few days.
Questions are now being asked about whether the opposition should continue its calls for fresh elections or instead push for key concessions and compromises from the government. And for the government of Hun Sen, they'll be hoping they don't have another Arab Spring on their hands.
That was Sam Belito reporting from Phnom Penh, Cambodia. Chinese authorities have publicly crushed over 6 tons of ivory in what conservationists say is the first serious attempt by the government in Beijing to show that the nation is willing to crack down on the trade. China accounts for about 70% of the world's trade in ivory, and it's estimated that more than 20,000 elephants were killed for their tusks last year. Conservationist Tom Milken from the organization Traffic told Lucy Carter that it's estimated that fewer than 500,000 elephants are left.
China has a legal ivory trade, and up until now, the Chinese government has been focused upon providing an environment where that legal trade can exist. But in doing so, and not carefully regulating the market, there's been a huge upsurge of illegal ivory moving into China. And the event today is really emblematic of the degree of illegal trade going to China.
Do you believe that this burning of over 6 tons of ivory in China signals a shift in the Chinese attitude towards ivory?
Yes, it's the first time that the government has really done something this public. And if you see the photographs, it's not only raw ivory, but the kinds of work products that are available in China. And I think this is, in a country like China, government leadership on an issue like this is hugely important. We're also seeing Chinese celebrities take up this cause. The world-famous basketball player Yao Ming has launched the Don't Buy Ivory campaign. So we're starting to see major movement in the world's largest market for ivory to try to turn people away from, you know, unbridled consumption.
And are you confident that this is actually a change in direction for China rather than, say, a PR move for the global audience?
Well, there's a little bit of both in there, but I do think that at the same time we are seeing increased law enforcement efforts in China. China's making at least 2 ivory seizures every single day. Chinese government is putting a lot of attention now on policing its legal ivory market. Some previously accredited ivory dealers have been arrested and been given like 15-year sentences in prison. Just on a variety of fronts, we're seeing a commitment to stamping out illegal trade.
What would you like the next step to be?
Well, I think you have to create a new mindset that, as we've done in Japan, that, you know, the ownership of ivory is not a status symbol. And I think that when you see important celebrities, including Jackie Chan, moving away from ivory, that has an impact with certain peoples. And I think also the government in a place like China plays a major role in public opinion. And so the event that we just witnessed today is the first time we've seen the government in such a high-profile anti-ivory trade stand. And as that pulses out through the Chinese media today, and hopefully it's going to change Chinese thinking about what ivory really represents.
That was conservationist Tom Milken from the organization Traffic, speaking to Lucy Carter. The war of words between Papua New Guinea's opposition leader, Bedin Nama, and the Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, came to a standoff this week after Mr. O'Neill succeeded in blocking moves to have arrest warrants served on him and 2 other of his senior ministers. Mr. O'Neill has directed the police commissioner, Tom Kalunga, to investigate how due processes have been sidestepped and the involvement of police officers to topple his government. At a press conference this week, Mr. O'Neill said rogue police officers within the police force are being directed by opposition leader Nama to conduct a kangaroo court in breach of the proper processes. Prime Minister Peter O'Neill speaks next to Kandahar Sapati.
I have gone on press basically to warn the police commissioner and the police that they are failing their duty to effect or to execute the warrants of arrest on the prime minister and the treasurer and the defense minister. And I have given them the ultimatum to do so within 72 hours. Failure to do so, I have instructed my lawyers to institute a contempt of court proceedings against them, because this is a high-profile corruption case in our country, in Papua New Guinea.
Yesterday afternoon, Prime Minister O'Neill held a press conference to respond. Firstly, he had this to say about Mr. Nama.
You cannot go around arresting the Prime Minister of a country on a forged letter. What kind of a joke is that? Now, Bedin Nama needs to be a bit more responsible. He's an alternative Prime Minister of this country. Determination to become Prime Minister of this country at any cost is a concern to everything in Papua New Guinea. This is another attempt to try and stage a coup to try and overthrow a legitimate government. By trying to arrest the Prime Minister, by trying to arrest senior ministers of government, by an opposition leader who is leading the smallest number of members of parliament in opposition since independence.
Mr. O'Neill then laid out his response to the warrant issued against him.
Some rogue policemen within the police department handling this file without the jurisdiction of them and been allocated this file to handle. They are not investigating officers of these files. That responsibility lies with the task force. They have not taken into commands given to by their superiors as required in the discipline organization like the police force. This cannot continue. That is why today we have successfully sought a stay order on those bench warrants. That has been stayed now. And I want to inform the nation that I have also instructed the police commissioner to investigate all parties, including Belden Nama, for his role. The way he goes about inducing and contacting police men and women and contacting members of the defense force to try and meet his political agenda. Now, we are going to extend this investigation not only on these particular issues, where police officers who are not responsible for files are running around trying to make arrests on investigations that are going on. I have said this before. Nobody is above the law. That includes the Prime Minister. No citizen of this country is above the law. But it must be done with due care, with the national interest at heart, at a good image for our country, so that there is a perception that is building out there that we don't respect our rule of law in this country. We must make sure that we do all things in a proper way. The task force SWIP is already handling that case. They will make the announcements and make the necessary arrest as and when they conclude their investigation.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The brother of an Indian student who was brutally bashed in Melbourne late last year says he is concerned that the incident has left his brother in immigration limbo. Majawinder Singh has serious brain injuries because of the attack. He has now emerged from an induced coma, but his conditions remain serious. His family says they are unsure what will happen to the 20-year-old once he is well enough to leave hospital. Catherine Gurner reports from Melbourne.
More than a week after a night out with two friends left him in intensive care, Manrajwinder Singh's condition has only improved slightly.
He's still in the jaws of death.
The 20-year-old accounting student's brother, Yadwinder Singh, has remained at his side. Police say the trio was approached by a group of teenagers as they waited for a train at about 4 a.m. on December 29th, after a night out at the Melbourne casino. Manrajwinder Singh was kicked in the head and hit with a stick, while his friend was also hurt, and the third managed to run for help. Detective Senior Constable Adam Foley.
Obviously, it's an opportunistic crime. They've seen two vulnerable victims who were simply minding their own business.
His brother is somewhat more uncertain.
I can't figure it out. It's a racially motivated or it's a robbery thing. It's an opportunistic crime.
Police have charged three teenagers over the attack. They say they're members of a gang called KYR, or Kill Your Rivals. Gautam Gupta is a senior figure in Melbourne's Indian community. He says concerns are being raised with him over media reports the gang is targeting people of Indian appearance.
What's the police action plan? What is police going to do about it? How can the community help them?
Victoria Police wouldn't comment as the matter is before court, but it's a sensitive issue for the Melbourne Indian community. Just 3 years ago, Victoria's head of police admitted that crime against Indians was a real issue and some attacks were racially motivated. But the force has been adamant it has been working hard to tackle the problem. Meanwhile, a former local mayor and councillor, who himself is of Indian origin, Tim Singh Lawrence, says the incident has raised concerns about what support is provided to international students that fall victim to such attacks.
There isn't really a system of support for them when these events occur. I know from my work as a councillor in the northern suburbs that the victims of crime system doesn't provide enough support for any victims of crime. But when you're an international student, you don't have access to the welfare system and other aspects of the system here, you're doubly disadvantaged. So it seems that we haven't learnt the lessons from the last 5 or 6 years about how to supply support to students in these kind of situations.
Manrajwinder Singh's family says he faces months of rehabilitation and they're now worried about what will happen to his student visa if he can't pass the required medical test.
I'm really worried about his future. I don't know, even if he lives in Australia, so it would be really hard because because the procedure for the international student he was following, it's pretty difficult for him now.
A spokesman for the Immigration Minister, Scott Morrison, said provisions are in place for such circumstances to help ensure foreign students don't breach their visa conditions.
I just want to remind you right now that you can catch two editions of Focus Asia Pacific at 1330 UTC on Saturday and Sunday on 9335 kilohertz to Asia and to North America on 11880. And that's this Saturday and Sunday. And those two programs are hosted by Andy Sennett. Human rights campaigners in the Philippines are disappointed over the decision by the Supreme Court of Appeal. The court has ruled that $23 million from the estate of the late dictator Ferdinand Marcos belongs to the Philippine National Bank. Two banks, human rights groups, the Philippine government, and several Swiss-based foundations have lodged rival claims to the money. The court's decision should be the final chapter of the two-decade-long battle over the ill-gotten gains of the dictator who ruled the Philippines for 21 years until he was overthrown in 1986. For more, here's Karen Snowden.
Ferdinand Marcos died in exile in 1989, having stashed overseas some of the billions of dollars he, his relatives and cronies misappropriated. In 2002, Swiss authorities transferred more than $600 million to the Philippines National Bank, or PNB. It was under an escrow agreement, a form of legal safekeeping, and the PNB invested some of the money in the Singapore branch of a German bank, WestLB. In 2004, PNB released funds to the Philippines government, but $23 million remained in Singapore and has been battled over by the rival claimants ever since. Now Singapore's Court of Appeal has upheld a decision that the $23 million belongs to the now privately owned PNB. One of the claimants, representing thousands of victims of the Marcos regime, is CELDA, the Society of Ex-Detainees Against Detention and Arrest. CELDA's chairwoman, Marie Hilao Enriquez, is disappointed.
We don't welcome the decision of the Singapore court in that the decision does not recover for the Philippine government nor for the human rights violations victims, the plundered wealth of the Marcoses.
The Presidential Commission on Good Government has the job of retrieving the Marcos money and was one of the parties to the court case. The head of the commission, Andres Bautista, says as a claimant in the case, the human rights victims served only to drag out the process. He's confident of retrieving all the money now the court has ruled in PNB's favour.
We view this development in a positive light. The ownership actually belongs to the Republic because PNB entered into an escrow agreement with the Republic in the 1990s, wherein it serves as the trustee for the account.
Now that it's been confirmed that PNB is the holder of the money, legitimate holder of the money, how soon before it's returned to the Philippines Treasury and then can be put to use for the victims or for the land reform program?
Right. Well, again, hopefully as soon as possible. Again, these monies have been there for years. Again, we're hoping that no more appeals or no more other tactics or, other legal remedies will be resorted to again further prevent the remittance of these monies back to the Philippine National Treasury.
And then, of course, what's still outstanding is the payment of compensation for victims. A claims board is yet to be formed. Would you support calls for that to be put in place as soon as possible to get this process really moving?
Right. Again, we have been, Presidential Commission on Good Government under the Aquino administration was one of, I believe, the key agencies that pushed for the passage of the human rights compensation law.
Despite the decades of campaigning, it was only in February last year that President Benigno Aquino signed the act that will allow compensation for victims of human rights abuses under Marcos. Marie Hilao Enriquez says the board to process compensation claims should be formed without delay.
We are disappointed because the law would have been signed for 1 year now and it's not yet implemented. No? So we are urging President Aquino to really, really think about the formation of the claims board so that the law will be implemented now and the money will be distributed to hundreds of thousands of martial law victims, whom many of them are sickly and some are dying already.
And finally on the program, across the world, more than one-third of the people are obese or overweight. That's a staggering figure. But even worse is the news that obesity epidemic is affecting people in developing countries the most. Figures from the Overseas Development Institute show that in at least 30 years, the number of overweight and obese adults in the developing world has tripled to 900 million, while high-income countries' numbers increase just half as much. The report's co-author, Steve Wiggins, says the growth rates are alarming on the current trends. There will be a huge increase of people suffering from diseases such as certain types of cancer, diabetes, strokes, and heart attacks. He speaks next to Wendy Everett.
Asia has the distinction within the developing world of being one of those regions where the incidence of overweight and obese, although it's rising, is rising more slowly and has reached lower levels than we're seeing in other areas of the world. So, for example, if we take the middle-income countries where incomes have increased and waistlines have tended to expand correspondingly, Mexico and Egypt are examples of middle-income countries with two-thirds or more of the people who are overweight and obese. The Republic of Korea, South Korea, that has half the levels of overweight and obesity, and it has probably higher incomes than Egypt and Mexico. So some good things have happened in Asia, and if you prompted me to say what, well, in the case of Korea, it seems that people are sticking closer to the elements of traditional diet than we're seeing in, say, Egypt or Mexico. And, you know, steamed rice, fresh seafood, use of green vegetables in cooking, and the fast foods are coming into Korea, but there is still quite a strong sticking to traditional elements in there, which provide less calories and a more adequate diet for people who are having increasingly sedentary lives.
Could it also be that the traditional diet is in fact a lower calorie, more healthy diet in South Korea than in other countries?
Yes, indeed. Some elements of those traditional diets in Asia are probably ideal for people who spend their lives in an office, yes, you know, with relatively small amounts of fat in them, relatively small amounts of sugar. These are probably far better diets for people who are not leading vigorous and active life where you've got manual work dominating.
One of the major concerns is the health implication of poor diets and obesity and the enormous burden on public health care systems. Yet the report warns that governments are not doing enough to tackle the growing crisis. Why do you think they're reluctant to interfere?
There are several reasons that explain that. The first is that the problem that we're looking at is it's a rising tide, but it's under the radar, so to speak. It's not something that results in spectacular events. It doesn't produce natural disasters. It doesn't produce famines. It's a problem that creeps up on us, and it doesn't hit the headlines. So there isn't necessarily anything that's triggering politicians, because politicians are not put on the spot and forced to come up with some kind of initiative to deal with it. And then, of course, there are the obvious things on the political calculus. Who wants to take on the lobbies that will come from some parts of the food industry, some parts of agriculture, which say government has no right to talk about diets and influence people's diets? That's purely individual choice. And who wants to take on consumers who quite naturally do not want to see government in their dining rooms and in their kitchens? I don't want government telling me what I can eat. I don't mind some advice. I don't mind some nudging. But people are very wary of a situation where the state starts dictating this. So for all of those reasons, you know, not enough pressure to act, plus reluctance to enter an area which is likely to be controversial means that government reactions pretty much across the world have been fairly timid with respect to the social time bomb that overweight and obesity represent.
Yet you do point out that governments have led the way in efforts to limit smoking, say, in many countries. And though diet is a more diverse and complex issue than smoking, what kind of scope could there be for governments to take the lead in improving diets and therefore containing that likely blowout in health costs?
The first thing we need to understand is that for many people, the problem of an expanding waistline is not the result of a very bad diet. It's the result of a diet which is just a little bit more than adequate in terms of calories compared to their activity level. So for many people, we don't have to radically change their diet. It's shifting the diet a little bit in one direction. And that tells us that we may get to the policy goal of limiting the rise of overweight and obesity by nudging people, not shoving them, nudging them. And we can nudge them through information and education. We can regulate against certain foods in food processing. We can regulate the advertising of certain foods to children. And last but not least in the arsenal of public policy, we can perhaps change some of the prices of high-risk foods against the healthier options so that the healthier options become cheaper rather than being the more expensive options for people. And we do that, of course, through taxes and possibly by offsetting subsidies for the more healthy foods.
That was Steve Wiggins from the Overseas Development Institute talking about a report that he co-authored on the trends of obesity and overweightness around the world. He was speaking there with Wendy Everett. Well, we are now out of time. If you wish to contact us, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. You can find out more information by visiting the website of the program at www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. That's www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. Also, I want to remind you quickly again, you can catch another two editions of the program, Saturday and Sunday, at 1330 UTC. Those two programs will be produced and presented by Andy Sennett, and the frequencies are 9335 to Asia and 11880 to North America. So do tune in. So on behalf of the whole team that helped put the program together, I'm Keith Parent, wishing you well. We'll see you again very soon. Goodbye, everyone, and have a great weekend.